This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, October 16th, 2012. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, Mitt Romney and Barack Obama face off in their second presidential debate. Both foreign and domestic issues could be on the table, but questions are rising about the voices left out of the conversation and the commission behind the debates. Workers in Illinois protest the loss of jobs as a factory owned by Bain Capital gets ready to ship jobs overseas. And the death of a Yemeni detainee at Guantanamo Bay brings to focus the more than 80 prisoners who have been cleared for release but still remain in detention. Those stories and more coming up after this news.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. The U.S. Supreme Court refused to halt early voting in Ohio today. The denial was a single-sentence order, no explanation, no dissent. Ohio election officials had asked the court to stay a lower court decision that forced them to allow all voters to cast ballots on the 3 days before Election Day, refusing to let them limit those days to military personnel and expats. The ruling is a win for the Democratic Party and the Obama campaign, who claim that limiting early voting on those days would likely violate the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution because it would disproportionately affect low-income and minority voters. British officials announced today that they will not extradite a Scottish hacker to the United States. Gary McKinnon was first arrested in 2002 and accused of breaking into U.S. government computers. He admits to what the U.S. has called the biggest military computer hack of all time, but says he was looking for evidence of space alien activity. McKinnon has been diagnosed with psychiatric disorders and suicidal tendency. UK Interior Minister Theresa May.
I have concluded that Mr. McKinnon's extradition would give rise to such a high risk of him ending his life that a decision to extradite would be incompatible with Mr. McKinnon's human rights.
May added that UK prosecutors must now decide if McKinnon should face any charges there. U.S. officials in Israel have canceled dozens of scholarships for Gazan students. Rami Almagari has more.
U.S. officials canceled scholarships for at least 30 students from Gaza who had planned to attend West Bank colleges. A statement by the U.S. consulate in Jerusalem said that Israel would not allow the students to travel to the West Bank, so rather than lose the funds altogether, they granted them to other students. Israel granted travel permits to Gazan students during the program's first year, but this year refused to do so. That decision was upheld by the Israeli Supreme Court. The study program is run by the non-profit Amidist. They refused to comment. But 16-year-old Amidist student Merved Brace from Khan Yunis City says canceling the scholarships effectively cancels her hope.
Really is a bad decision that American consulate to stop this decision, but I need to him to change their opinion about that because they will destroy our dreams in Gaza.
The Israeli human rights writer group Gisha says that the High Court action upholding the travel ban violates basic human rights. Rami Almighari, FSRN, Gaza.
In Jerusalem, the Knesset voted to dissolve itself and set elections for January 22nd of next year. That's 8 months earlier than previously planned. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was unable to craft a passable budget without deep and unpopular cuts. Former Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic took the stand today on the first day of his defense at the International War Crimes Court at The Hague, where he's charged with war crimes and genocide.
Instead of being accused of the events in our civil war, I should be rewarded for all the good things I've done, namely that I did everything possible to avoid the war, that I succeeded in reducing the suffering of all civilians.
Translation courtesy of Al Jazeera. Karadzic is accused in the 1995 massacre at Srebrenica, when during just a few days about 8,000 Muslim boys and men were executed. He claims he's innocent, saying no policy was being carried out and he did not know prisoners would be killed. He also faces charges related to the nearly 4-year siege of Sarajevo, during which about 12,000 civilians died. More Chicago-area teachers are on strike today. 400 educators from North Shore School District 112 were on the picket line and more than 4,000 students were out of class. The strike is about wage levels and retirement benefits. Teacher Tony DiBenedetto spoke to WBBM Radio.
We really understand, you know, the today's economy, and we're asking for a very reasonable offer, and we've been met with basically a brick wall.
Three schools opened as activity centers for pre-registered students. Negotiations are ongoing. For FSRN from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. President Barack Obama and Republican challenger Mitt Romney take the stage for a town hall debate tonight at Hofstra University in New York. But despite questions coming from audience members, nearly every aspect of the debate is tightly dictated and pre-approved by the two major party candidates and the private corporate-sponsored Commission on Presidential Debates. While some advocates are pressuring the commission to allow for more open questioning and the inclusion of third-party candidates, other groups are organizing alternative debates of their own. FSRN's Alice Olstein reports.
On the morning of Tuesday's presidential debate, voters in Washington, D.C. shared what they would ask if they had the chance.
Yeah, I would ask the candidates what they plan to do about climate change, seeing as we saw the warmest July on record. No one's talking about it.
As a gay person, really what I'm most concerned about is, do you see the president's job as protecting civil rights or rescinding civil rights?
And Romney, why should we continue to help him get more money, put more money in his pocket?
Something along the lines of explaining a little bit more about the implications to the tax code in their plans. I'd like to get a little bit of resolution on that.
That's what presidential town hall debates used to be like. Random, ordinary voters asking spontaneous questions of the candidates. But the town hall debate Tuesday night between President Barack Obama and challenger Mitt Romney won't be anything like that, because each campaign signed a binding memorandum of understanding with the Commission on Presidential Debates. That document, which was kept secret until Time magazine published a leaked copy this week, covers and controls every detail of the debates, including the angle of the TV camera shots, the temperature of the room, the color and size of the backdrop, how the moderator addresses each candidate, and which media outlets are allowed in. Robert Weissman with Public Citizen is one of the many transparency advocates who has been petitioning the commission to release this memo, and he's not surprised by what was revealed.
Apparently, both the campaigns think they have a shared interest in protecting their candidates from any kind of push, press, or demand for direct response from those outside of the campaign itself.
At the town hall-style debate, the audience will be pre-selected by the Gallup organization to be nationally demographically representative. Their questions have been pre-screened and selected by the moderator, CNN's Candy Crowley, but her role is limited to just calling on the audience members to ask their questions and enforcing the candidates' time limits. If an audience member tries to ask a follow-up question or ask a different question than the one they submitted, they'll have their mic shut off. The memorandum also says the candidates can't ask each other direct questions during any of the debates or participate in any debate outside the three sanctioned and organized by the commission. Obama and Romney can't even appear on a news show at the same time. Weissman believes these limits are bad for voters.
In the Citizens United world, more than ever, we have campaigns that are defined by negative attack ads run by the campaigns and even more run by outside interests. So the debates, as formal as they may be, as artificial as they may be, at least they actually give us an unfiltered take on the candidates themselves with longer answers, hopefully serious answers to serious questions.
Weissman called the debates the best thing we have going for an informed democracy. But for some, that's not good enough. Christina Tobin with the Free and Equal Elections Foundation is holding alternative debates this month, featuring several third-party candidates excluded from the official commission-sponsored debates.
We're going to have interaction, let the people submit their own questions and be voting on which questions they want to have for this debate. And we're going to have a final debate, a week later, October 30th, in Washington, D.C., of which through instant runoff voting, the two candidates that the people decide will proceed to that debate.
The first debate, in Chicago on October 23rd, will feature candidates from the Green Party, Libertarian Party, Constitution Party, and Justice Party. It will be streamed online and aired by some national and international media outlets. But the Green Party's Jill Stein says her participation in alternative debates doesn't mean she'll stop fighting for inclusion in the official ones.
It's a good thing, but it is a second-class debate, and they'll be seen only by a tiny fraction of voters. They really deserve to be prime time, and the American people deserve to know who their choices are and what the real solutions are.
Stein spoke to FSRN on her way to the Hofstra University Arena, where she and her running partner Sherry Honkala tried unsuccessfully to enter the debate security perimeter. After sitting together in protest in the street, they were removed and detained by police. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
One of the issues the next U.S. president will face is the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center. Although largely missing from the candidates' campaigns, human rights advocates and lawyers have been pushing for justice for dozens of detainees, many of whom have been cleared for release. Despite the high-profile hearing this week of five detainees facing charges related to the September 11th terrorist attacks, the majority of prisoners at the military base in Cuba have never been charged or brought to trial, and according to the U.S. government, more than 80 have been cleared for release. More than half of those are from Yemen, but in 2010, President Obama issued a memorandum blocking the release of Yemeni detainees. The year before, Obama signed an executive order which called for the prompt closure of facilities at Guantanamo. For more, we're joined by Pardis Cabriai, senior staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. She represents current and former detainees at Guantanamo. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you very much for having me.
In September, the U.S. Justice Department released the names of 55 Guantanamo detainees who have been cleared for release. Why are they still in detention?
Those are people who are subject to, group punishment. Their continuing detention at Guantanamo has nothing to do with the individual allegations against them or their individual conduct. It has to do with their national origin. So those men, at least more than half of the names that have been released are men from Yemen, and they could go home tomorrow if that ban were lifted.
And that ban was the moratorium put in place by President Obama in January 2010, which followed the planned bombing of an airplane headed towards Detroit. The suspect in that case had alleged ties to Yemen. Is that correct?
That's right. It's a ban that went into effect just days after that attempted attack. It's in effect, as I said, a blanket ban on the repatriation of any citizen of Yemen back to their country, whether they've been cleared or not. And currently, we're talking about the number of men who've been cleared. There are actually 86 men of the remaining prisoners at Guantanamo. There are 166 people who remain. More than half of them have been cleared, and more than half of that cleared group are men from Yemen.
So just to be clear on the numbers, 86 have been cleared for release, but the Justice Department has only released the identity of 55 of them. Is that right?
That's right, and they so there are more men who have been cleared whose names we do not know yet. I think the Justice Department may be in the process of releasing further names, but at this point, only 55 have been released.
And those who have been cleared for release, what is the process their cases have gone through so that the government has determined that they should be released?
Well, there's a government task force that's been set up that includes representatives from intelligence, Department of Justice, Department of State. As I said, every government, there's a representative from every agency of the government that has a stake in detentions at Guantanamo, and the decision to approve them to clear is based on a unanimous decision of every one of those individuals that a person does not need to remain at Guantanamo for the purpose of the national security of the United States. So it's an important determination. It means that the government has effectively decided that that person does not need to remain.
That's Pardis Cabriai with the Center for Constitutional Rights. Now, one of the detainees who had been cleared for release is Yemeni Adnan Latif. Last month, Latif was found dead in his cell, and we're joined now by Mark Falkoff. He's the defense attorney for Latif. Mark Falkoff, your client, Adnan Latif, had been cleared for release by both the Bush administration and the Obama administration. Why was he kept in detention?
For years, no one has really believed that Adnan belonged at Guantanamo at all. So you're absolutely right when the Bush administration and the military under President Bush reviewed the dossier for his case and looked at the allegations against him, it decided that this is really not a guy who belongs at Guantanamo at all. If this is a prison that's really designed to hold the worst of the worst, then at the very least, this was not one of them. Adnan was not one of them. So he was recommended for release by the administrations at least three times in 2004, 2006, and 2008. He was also recommended for release by the Obama administration when it came into office and reviewed the detainee files. That was in 2009. So it's rather remarkable that he was there at all. Really, the key to this puzzle is that it became politically untenable to be returning prisoners generally home from Guantanamo, but particularly to Yemen, which has obviously been in a rather unstable state for a while.
In early September, officials say Adnan Latif was found dead in his cell. Is it clear how he died?
It is absolutely not clear how he died. An autopsy was performed on him, at least that's what's been reported to us. We do not know the results of the autopsy. The government hasn't told us yet. We don't know whether it was perhaps a suicide. Certainly he had attempted suicide in the past. He was a repeat hunger striker. It was really his only way to protest what he saw as the injustice of his detention. So it's, it seems to me equally plausible that the ill effects on his health from literally years of hunger striking just had put him in such a weakened state that his just lack of will to live may have led to his death.
So the autopsy results have yet to be released?
That's correct.
And how old was Adnan Latif?
He was 35 or 36.
Mark Falkoff is a former defense attorney for Adnan Latif, who died last month at Guantanamo Bay Prison. He had been cleared multiple times for release by the U.S. government. Mark Falkoff, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. Thank you.
A group of auto part workers in Freeport, Illinois, are staging a protest encampment directly across the street from the factory that is shipping their jobs to China. The workers at Sensata Technologies have been protesting for 5 weeks now and have dubbed their encampment Bainport. It's a reference to Bain Capital, the investment firm that owns the factory and is set to outsource the jobs. Bain Capital is also the firm that was run by U.S. presidential candidate Mitt Romney and continues to provide Romney with millions of dollars in tax breaks and retirement income. FSRN's Kelly Benjamin reports.
Shortly after Bain Capital purchased Sensata Technologies in early 2011, company officials scheduled a meeting with workers to inform them that they'd be losing their jobs. The company that makes sensors and controls for automobiles was moving its operations to China. Tom Galrap has worked at the factory for 33 years and was at that meeting.
My original view was they didn't get it. They didn't understand that moving these jobs out of communities like this, the impact it has, the destruction it does to communities, the destruction it does to families. You work with these people for years that you're in there with, and they become another family. And there's a good chance you're never going to see them again. They don't understand what it does to people and what it does to communities, just purely for greed. But the longer this has gone on, the more that second possibility looms, that they just don't care.
Galrap and dozens of his Sensata Technology co-workers first took their plight to the Freeport City Council, where they succeeded in convincing council members to pass a resolution calling on Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney to step in and save their jobs from being outsourced. Romney, the former CEO of Bain Capital, could profit from outsourcing these jobs to China. According to the New York Times, he owns millions of dollars worth of Bain funds that hold 51% of Sensata shares. But the presidential candidate has refused to comment on the situation in Freeport, despite Gallrap and his co-workers' multiple attempts to meet with him. They've been locked out of Midwest Bank Capital headquarters and two separate Romney campaign offices. So after traveling to Tampa, Florida in August to raise the issue at the Republican National Convention, the workers decided to step it up a notch when they got home.
Then when we got back from Tampa, we realized that the time was getting so very short that we were going to have to go for a big thing. And kind of out of desperation then, we set up tents here. And like you said, we've been here 32 days.
The collection of tents called Bainport houses close to two dozen Sensata workers and supporters. The encampment sits on the Stevenson County Fairgrounds, directly across from the factory, and is being used by permission from Freeport's mayor, George Gallrap, no relation to Tom.
Of course I'm going to, as the mayor of City Freeport, support them. They're a great group of people. They're hard workers. They have longevity here. They're competitive globally, and their jobs are being ripped from underneath them for really no reason other than maximizing profit somewhere else. And now all of a sudden you have 170 good-paying jobs with great benefits leaving that have been here for decades.
Last week, as semi-trucks began arriving to remove factory equipment in preparation for the plant's closing at the end of this year, some workers and supporters attempted to block the trucks from entering by sitting down in the street. Police arrested three people, including 16-year-old Carrie Peniston, whose mother Joanne has worked at the plant for 8 years.
I just couldn't leave from the front of the truck. It was, I felt like it was my job to stand in front of that truck and stand up for what I believe in.
This past weekend at the Bainport encampment, the protesting workers were paid a visit by 15 former employees from a Samsonite luggage factory in France, who also saw their jobs outsourced to China by Bain Capital in 2007. The French and American workers shared a meal and swapped stories about their mutual struggle. The French workers were visiting the U.S. in order to file a lawsuit in federal court against Bain Capital for illegal termination. Attorney Fedor Rilov is representing them.
Well, French law says that if you close down a company while you're already making big profits, and that the objective of the closing down of the company is to make even more profits because, for example, you're going to outsource the activity to China or somewhere else. But that's a legal offense. Yeah, you're not allowed to do that. You're not allowed to put people out on the road just to make more money. You can do it if you lose money, if things are going badly. Yeah, of course, you can dismiss people. But if you're making a lot of money and you want to make even more, that's not authorized.
The visit of the laid-off French workers was inspiring for Freeport resident Beth McGowan, who has supported the Sensata workers in their plight.
The United States has fewer laws and regulations that protect workers than in many other Western countries. If a company in France is making money, and the only reason for firing you is that they want to make more money, that is an illegal action in France. That is almost unthinkable in the United States. It's as if, the freedom to lay people off is the most important freedom in the United States. The freedom to make a profit is the only freedom that really matters. And in France, they believe that a freedom to make a living and to have some kind of security in life is also an important freedom.
In Freeport, the Sensata workers concede that the outlook for saving their jobs looks bleak, but they plan to continue their protests and are receiving widespread international support for their plight.
Short of a miracle, we're not going to be able to save our jobs, but if some company somewhere is thinking about doing this, and they go, wow, those people in Freeport really raised a ruckus. You know, do we want all the negative publicity that goes with that? Do we really need to do it? If we can save one job someplace, then camping in that tent for 32 days has been worth it.
Representatives of Bain Capital and the Romney campaign have been mostly quiet regarding the Sensata worker protest in Freeport and did not respond to requests for comment on this story. This week, the Sensata workers are being paid a visit by Illinois Senator Dick Durbin, as well as activist and TV host Al Sharpton. The workers hope to create enough of a buzz about losing their jobs to China that Mitt Romney will be forced to answer to the issue in one of the remaining presidential debates. Kelly Benjamin, FSRN, Freeport, Illinois.
Free Speech Radio News is a choice that matters to you. You've made a commitment to listen to the progressive, fearless, independent journalism we produce daily. With 200 freelance journalists around the globe, FSRN is on the ground where crisis occurs and where the news of the day affects local communities. We've led the way in covering many critical issues, from the effects of state laws on undocumented immigrants and the battle for voters' rights.
I know that this law would have a devastating effect. It has already had devastating effects. It's going back to the Jim Crow days.
To the attacks on women around the world and the response to climate change on the grassroots level.
Say no to this idea of a green economy. That is not real. That is a false solution as well. Economy cannot be green. It's just twisting around capitalism.
No one else can bring you this coverage the way we do. Find out more about how to support FSRN, a choice that matters, by going to our website, fsrn.org.
In the latest challenge to controversial practices by big banks, a group of African-American homeowners has sued investment giant Morgan Stanley for alleged predatory lending practices that targeted borrowers from minority communities. The suit was filed Monday in New York, where the company is based. FSRN's Salim Rizvi has more.
A coalition of legal groups, including the ACLU, filed the class action suit on behalf of five African-American Detroit residents. The complaint alleges that Morgan Stanley discriminated against black homeowners by targeting them for subprime loans. The ACLU says the suit is the first to link bundling of mortgage-backed securities and racial discrimination. Plaintiffs say Morgan Stanley targeted minority neighborhoods with high-cost loans that were at risk of default. It then profited from purchasing and financing these predatory mortgages by converting them into liquid securities that were put out in the market. Larry Schwartzstall is an attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union representing the plaintiffs.
In this case, Morgan Stanley was conducting its business in a way that had severe unequal consequences for minority borrowers and communities. And this lawsuit seeks to establish that that's a violation of federal civil rights laws and that Wall Street can be held accountable for those violations.
According to the suit, Morgan Stanley's practices violate both federal and state laws, including the Fair Housing Act, the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, and Michigan's Civil Rights Act. The lawyers say this is the first time an investment bank has been sued directly instead of a lender for violating federal housing and civil rights laws. They allege the banks are targeting blacks and Latinos for predatory lending practices across the nation, and thousands of homeowners in the Detroit area alone could be affected. Ruby McCoy, a mother of four, is one of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit.
In the past 12 months, I've been under an enormous amount of stress trying to shield the mortgage situation from my children, while trying to keep the house that we've lived in for so many years. It was kind of hard for me to explain to my children about the situation I was in with the mortgage. It was hard for me to explain to them as well as to my family because I don't quite understand the situation myself.
Plaintiffs are asking the court to certify the case as a class action suit and damages for the named plaintiffs. Morgan Stanley isn't the only financial giant to be accused of discrimination. Over the last year, both Wells Fargo and Bank of America settled with the Justice Department for discriminating against people of color by steering them to risky and high-cost subprime mortgages. Salim Rizvi, FSR in New York.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Rose Katapshi and Janine Etter. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.